on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 89-year-old Warren Smith of Fresno, California. He served with I Company, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marine Division during World War II, getting his first taste of combat on Saipan, where he went ashore as an assistant BAR man and was pressed into duty as a runner after the lieutenant's previous runner disappeared. Before we jump back into his personal perspective, how about a little overview on Saipan? We've heard from plenty of veterans over the years on this program who served on that island. And between the 2nd Marine Division, 4th Marine Division, and the 27th Infantry Division, there were more than 70,000 Americans fighting a little more than 30,000 troops of the Japanese Imperial Army on an island that doesn't quite cover 45 square miles in the Northern Mariana Islands. Saipan remains U.S. territory today, and if you visit there, you'll find a couple of sites that are on the U.S. National Register of Historic Places. That would be Suicide Cliff and Bonsai Cliff, two spots where some of World War II's most tragic moments unfolded. As Americans were overpowering the Japanese forces on Saipan, there were a couple of motivating factors that led civilians, both Japanese and the native inhabitants of Saipan, the Chamorros, to jump off of those two cliffs to their deaths. You might remember there was Japanese propaganda telling the civilians about the horrible things American soldiers might do to them. Of course, that was not true. And there was also an imperial order from Emperor Hirohito telling civilians that their status in the afterlife would increase if they committed suicide there rather than be taken prisoner. It's really not pleasant to talk about, but it's one of the things that the Battle of Saipan is most remembered for. Strategically, Saipan was a very important victory for American forces. It enabled them to move within striking distance of mainland Japan. B-29s from Saipan and, of course, nearby Tinian were bombarding the Philippines and Japan not long after those islands were secured. Our guest today, Warren Smith, was part of that effort to win that battle that lasted from June 15th to July 9th, 1944. And let's get back to his story now. Warren, when we left off, you mentioned having to evacuate a wounded Marine. So the enemy's exploding artillery shells over your position. This guy is hit bad. He's bleeding all over. And you guys put him on a stretcher, and you had to get him out of there. Of course, the enemy's still firing. And what do you remember about the condition this wounded Marine was in?
He was pretty bad. I never really heard what happened to him, but he was in pretty bad shape. We was going back to medical station. All I can remember is starting carrying him down there. The rest of it I cannot recollect. As whether we came back up to our unit or not, I don't know.
When you see something like that, and you're carrying him, you know, on the stretcher, you're close enough to see what his condition is and what that's doing to him. And does that make you think, boy, what if this happens to me? This could happen to me?
That's right. You think, oh, Ben, that could have been me.
What about the day-to-day conditions on Saipan? What kinds of things you were dealing with? What the enemy was like? What do you remember about that?
Our condition wasn't all that bad. We were short of water for a couple of days, and we got a canteen probably a day, and you'd pour your water in the canteen lid and sip that down, try to make it last. And then the water tasted terrible. it tested like sulfur water that you find different places in the country here now.
It doesn't sound like a very pleasant place to be. What do you think enabled you to keep going and to not just get down and miserable and scared and paralyzed by that fear and desperation?
That's something that I don't know. It's a job that has to be done, and everybody else is doing it with you.
Well, that's what I wondered, if that was part of it, if there was some strength in numbers or knowing that the guy next to you is going through the same thing.
I'm sure that's part of it, yes.
And you said that when that battle started, you were thinking, when's this going to be over? How am I going to get out of here? I know it didn't end the way for you that you wanted it to, but when you spent day after day in those conditions, you know, sleeping outdoors in this, you know, tropical island, did it seem like it was going to last forever? Did you have any expectation that it was getting close to over?
I can't remember of even thinking about when it would be over, really. I'd just be glad when it is over. And as far as our conditions, we C rations, they weren't too bad, or K rations. Yeah. And they brought up hot food once in a while. So it wasn't bad like some of them did in the Guadalcanal when they were short of food and had a hard time getting them in there.
What was your impression of the guys that you were fighting against, of what the enemy was like and what you had to be prepared for?
I don't know whether I had any feeling about them or not. I just know that they was the enemy and they were doing what they'd been told to do. That is all I can say about them. I said, if you shot at somebody, there are other people was shooting at him too, so you don't know whether you hit him or other people hit him.
Yeah, I guess that's the hard thing for us who haven't been in those combat situations to understand how chaotic it is.
Police officers, that is bad for them. That is bad after they have to shoot somebody. I can't imagine what they go through.
But because of the situation you were in, you felt it was a little different?
Well, yeah, they were our enemy. They were a different situation, you know. And you had to hunt them out. They would throw a grenade at you. They would kill themselves before they would let you capture them.
Yeah.
Most of them did. We captured a few. Mm-hmm. But I went through one cave after the island was secure months afterwards, and there was a cave in there. There was probably 100 people that had killed themselves with their rifles, tie a string to their toe and stick it in their mouth.
I'm sure you saw a lot of things that that you'd never seen before and maybe have never seen since. How long was it until you were wounded? Because this was the battle where they got a piece of you, right?
We landed June the 15th, and I was evacuated on July the 8th.
Tell me about that. What happened? How were you hurt?
Well, we had pushed them out into the ocean, and there was some trying to escape, and there was a group of civilians here. And there was one soldier that somebody had shot, and somebody got wounded, so I was guarding till they got him out of there. And I got hit in the leg, whether it was enemy fire or our own fire, I don't know. Everybody was firing. That's about all I can say.
So you got hit in the leg. Did you feel pain, or was it just...
More like somebody hits you and gives you a Charlie horse, and I grabbed it like that. And there was a kind of a knot there like you can get. And then I looked at my hand and there was blood on it. And so somebody hollered for a medic. And he started doctoring the front of my leg. And I said, I'm hit back here. Well, the thing had went clear through and I hadn't noticed that, you know.
Wow.
Didn't break no bones. It went through between the bones. Mm-hmm. So I didn't suffer any real damage.
Is that something that you look back on and you're thankful because it could have been a lot worse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have no ill effects of it today. Mm. Never did have.
And that was, if I remember right, July 8th was just about the end of that battle, wasn't it?
Probably 2 weeks went on. They had pushed them on out to the end of the island and they was jumping over the cliffs and killing their family and stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't get in on any of that.
Well, and you bring that up and I was going to ask you about that because so many people who were on Saipan have mentioned that. And the context was the Japanese were telling the natives this propaganda that what you guys were going to do to them was worse than jumping off that cliff. When you found out about that, I know you've seen death. You've been around these battles and the carnage, but to find out that these mothers and children were jumping off that cliff, how hard was that to swallow?
You just couldn't imagine that people would be doing that to themselves when we weren't going to hurt them at all. By the way, there was a few Japanese soldiers that did surrender. I think there was probably.
So you're wounded. You get evacuated. I'm sure they took good care of you. And then how much longer did you stay on Saipan?
Oh, I was left the next day. Yeah. They sent me out to hospital ship and took me down to New Caledonia and stayed down there. Then they sent me back to Hawaii, and I don't know when I got there, and I don't know when I joined the unit again. But I know when we got hit with a suicide plane.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that too. Was it hard for you to leave those other guys you'd been fighting with when you were wounded and evacuated? Were you thinking about them still out there fighting these Japanese?
Oh, maybe a little, not much.
Yeah.
But you think about them. And two, I hadn't been with them that long, really. No, there was still a lot of them in the unit when I got back to them.
And once you get wounded like that, I've had different guys tell me different things about them. Some of them say, well, I figure it was only a matter of time till I was going to get hit again. And some of them say, well, you know, if that's the worst that's going to happen, maybe I'm going to be all right. You know, did it make you feel worse or better or neither?
Well, it made me feel any different at all. But I know when we found out that the war was over, everybody went wild. We was out on maneuvers, and of course nobody knew what an atomic bomb was and how much damage it had done. And I remember thinking, well, I can take my rifle and shoot and sink a battleship with it. Should have got that much explosives. But we found out it wasn't quite like that.
Yeah, not exactly. I do want to hear about how that all happened and what you remember about the end of the war, but you had some other hair-raising moments while the war was still going on. Whether or not your rifle works correctly can be a matter of life or death, and I know you had two different rifles, as many did, the M1 Garand as well as a carbine. You had an incident that I think if our listeners are paying attention to, they're going to feel a bit of the panic that you might have felt in the moment. You were on guard duty?
One night, you got somebody on guard all the time, you know. And so I seen a Jap running towards us, and I thought, well, I'm going to let him get close enough, coming right for us, that I know I can get him if it's a Japanese. And so I hollered halt, and he turned to run, and I pulled the trigger, and nothing happened. Cocked it again, pulled the trigger, nothing happened. Well, I picked up my M1 and shot, but he was clear out of range in the air where I couldn't see him. And I was using the carbine. That's the lighter one. And it had dirt in the bolt, so the bolt wouldn't go clear shut. Yeah. And if it had been the M1, it would have shammed right on in there. But yeah. I hated that thing from then on.
Well, hey, at least it didn't cost you your life, huh?
And then there was one night, there was me and a corporal and our lieutenant was in one shell hole. And I guess I was dreaming or something. They said, I woke up and grabbed the lieutenant by the leg and started shaking and saying, they're coming, they're coming, they're coming. And they said, I laid back down and just laughed and went on sleeping.
I haven't heard that one before. I've heard of the flashbacks after you get home, but that's a new one.
He was a good guy, that lieutenant was, and he got killed before the fight was over.
It can't be easy when you're losing men like that whom you respect, and you're getting shot at, you're missing all the comforts of home. And it kind of sounds like you just got used to all of that.
That was just the thing we put up with. In Europe, they got some prisoners and they come back there and here guys are got soda, a kitchen set up to them and a lot of equipment. And they said, well, how in the hell did they ever expect to win this war with this type of stuff going on? People was happy, you know. They didn't even think about having Cokes and stuff to drink, you know.
All about perspective. So you're wounded, you recuperate, you rejoin your unit. And you guys were heading into Okinawa on an LST?
Yes, on an LST. We got up there and we was a diversionary landing. Made a run like we was going to land. And you could see the trucks and stuff pulling into the beach where they thought we was going to land. And then the main invasion was on the other side. And so we had an air raid. And whenever you have air raids on ship, they want you below deck. Because you're less apt to get hurt down there than you are on deck. And then the plane hit. They had us come up.
Well, hold on a second here. So this is Okinawa, and probably of all the battles in the Pacific, the one the most infamous for kamikazes was Okinawa. So you're below deck. You can't see anything coming. You don't know what's happening. How did you experience this kamikaze attack?
Well, you just heard the thing hit the ship, and that's about all. And then the ship was on fire, and they wanted us on deck. They had gasoline drums up there. And they wanted us to throw the gasoline drums overboard, and one of our sergeants was grabbing them 50-gallon buns and throwing them over. Ended up, he was throwing the empty ones over.
Well, and you can laugh about that now, but I'm imagining being there. You're below deck. A kamikaze crashes into the ship, armed with a 500-pound bomb that could detonate. And they want you to go find the explosive material and throw it overboard? I mean, the last thing I would want to do is get near any gas at that point.
They wanted off of there so it wouldn't explode and burn us all up, you know.
Right.
They had a lot of liquid up there, so they wanted to get rid of it.
So you're up on the deck. There's a fire burning on another part of the ship, and you're throwing gasoline overboard.
Drums. Until they told us to abandon ship.
That sounds like a pretty scary and panicked situation to me. What do you remember about it?
All I can remember is just shoving the drums over, get them off of here. That's the only thing I can remember thinking about it.
And how close was the fire to you?
It was down below deck, down in the engine room.
So they say abandon ship, and you're on the deck of an LST. That's not like stepping off into a wading pool. That's a long way down to the water, right?
Not as far as the troop ships are.
Right.
And they're the same way.
They say abandon ship. What do?
Put on your life jacket. Well, you already had the life belt on. You just jump over and press the thing to inflate it. And that's the Baldell, and we was picked up by a tug, which had the best food I ever had in my life. We was crowded up there like fleas on a cat.
I mean, you're making this sound like no big deal. But, I mean, that sounds crazy to me. How far down to the water was it from the edge of that LST?
It wasn't that far, really. You don't even think about it anyhow, you know.
Yeah.
It isn't like getting up on a big platform and jumping off into a swimming pool.
Uh-huh.
You just jump.
And you were picked up almost immediately, or you had to float for a while?
A little bit, 30 minutes or something like that. One guy, he inflated his life belt before he jumped over because he couldn't swim. And when he hit the water, it was up and it busted the thing and it fell off of him. And he's swimming away and doing fine. And he discovered that was fine. That was gone. And he said he started going down and he told himself, he said, well, you're doing all right before, get back up. And he got back up and somebody picked him up, you know,
Wow. Somebody
that had a life jacket.
But you don't remember having to wonder if you were going to get picked up?
No, there was a lot of ships. We were right close to shore, so there was a lot of ships around there. Before we got hit, I can remember some of the planes, Japanese planes being way high. A particular one, he'd start to dive down and they'd get his range and he'd go back up. And finally he came clear on down and missed the ship that he was trying to hit. But like I was telling Jeff, these were not really trained people to kamikaze. They were just regular pilots. So he was naturally trying to get away from it for a while. The ones that was a kamikaze, that was all they were supposed to do, is find a ship, get on a plane, fly it. That's all they wanted to know. Fly there and hit the ship.
You know, I've read one estimate that only 19% of kamikaze pilots were able to actually crash their planes into ships. Kamikaze in Japanese means divine wind. And as a strategy, employing those suicide planes was something that increased dramatically the more desperate the situation got toward the end of the war. There were reportedly 5,000 additional kamikaze pilots on standby when Japan surrendered. But during the war, approximately 3,800 of them died in attempted attacks on enemy targets. Nearly 1,500 of those were part of a single battle, Okinawa, the spot where Warren Smith and his LST were hit. That's not the end of his story, though. We'll talk about the rest of his time in World War II and another adventure he's been able to enjoy just in the past year. Remember, if you're listening in Central California and you're headed to that Fresno State football game next Saturday against Southern Utah, Warren is going to be the hero of the game. Look for him at halftime. And if you don't want to wait that long to see what he looks like, you can find photos of him right now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and, of course, at hometownheroesradio.com. And Hometown Heroes will come right back after this.